So it's a real pleasure to be here. So because the title of my talk was Simulation Tools for Neutrino Experiments, I thought that I should try to cover more than one tool. But as I am a member of GENI, I'm going to focus for the most part on GENI. So I'll talk a little bit about what the accelerator, neutrino software stack looks like, what GENI is, how it works, sort of what's going on, what we're planning on doing. And then I'll talk very briefly about other generators and tools. And I'll mention that I'm not going to talk about Newt, which is a big omission in the field. But I'm not really an expert, so I'm going to refrain from commenting. And I'm also not going to say a lot about Jayant for the opposite reason, which is that I expect that most people who are interested in what Jayant is already have some decent idea of what it does. And so I just can't talk about everything. No, okay, that's too big. This is the much more fun way to point. Anyway. Okay, so unfortunately I have a bunch of slides that just have lots of text, so I'll try to do my best with those. So just some history and some perspectives on how neutrino event generators work and sort of why they are the way they are. So, I think a lot of people would argue the most natural theory community partner for neutrino event generators is the nuclear theory community. Now, there's some debate about that, but it's, I think, clear that the NP theory community is very important, and due to sort of bureaucratic reasons in the United States, at least, they've been sort of largely walled off from each other. So this means that the generators are in heavy use at experiments, so GENI and Newt, for example, were largely developed and maintained by experimentalists. So, the inmates have control of the asylum. So more theory-oriented generators came from Europe, although even GENIs came from the UK via the Minos experiment, and often lacked critical tools that we need in experiments. So a flux driver, geometry drivers, tools for handling uncertainties, those sorts of things. So even if they sometimes had better physics, they lost out on these other pieces. Anyway, so the two generator types, the ones that were born in the experiments, the ones that were born outside, are sort of moving towards each other. So things are getting better in that regard. But in general, this is definitely a situation that we're sort of looking to remedy. And so I'll point to track records for recent success. So Aaron will talk in a little bit. I don't know if he'll talk about the Z expansion, but we regard this as a very successful example of a collaboration with the theory group for getting a new model into GENI. But the model probably needs work in order to best serve all parties. It's not clear that we have a good mechanism for really giving credit to theorists who work with us in a way that's most supporting for their own career advancement. And then also, it'd be great just to have theorists just directly join generator groups. As it is, like I said, we're effectively all staffed by experimentalists and could use diversity. Okay, so and then there's another perspective that I always like to put into these kinds of talks, which is that typically, in these sorts of interactions, theorists like to say that, model doesn't need to match the data, it just needs to be correct. And the experimentalist argues, it doesn't need to be correct, it just needs to match the data. And both camps are really quite pleased with their positions. But this leads to a lot of funny tensions, and it's worth keeping in mind.
Just to clarify, when you say model is whatever is coded inside your simulation, so that includes both nuclear and nucleon.
Yeah, the whole thing, the model, the whole big model. I should have put capital M. Anyway, okay, so what does the software stack look like for a neutrino experiment, at least an accelerator neutrino experiment? Well, it's basically broken into three pieces. So there's a beamline simulation that produces a flux prediction, and there's big uncertainties in there coming from hadron production, focusing, simulation of the beamline, all that sort of stuff. That's usually done with Fluca or Jayant. There's the event generator, which handles the neutrino-nucleus interaction. So GENI is the example I use here. And it encodes the interaction physics. It encodes the nuclear medium, these sorts of different pieces. And then you have a detector simulation, which basically handles the particles that have exited the nucleus. Now, there's some exceptions to that, because Jayant is conservative about how it decays certain particles, and it won't decay certain things sometimes. And so sometimes the generator is asked to do that sort of stuff. But for the most part, once the particle leaves the nucleus, it's no longer the responsibility of the event generator. And then the other thing to keep in mind is people sometimes ask, why is this a problem at all? We know how neutrinos interact with things. And that's true in some cases. So if you're working with simple vertices, we're in good shape. If we were scattering off free nucleons, we would be even in decent shape, because we're much better able to parameterize our ignorance. But the problem, the bigger problem we have here is that we're scattering in some complex nucleus. And so it's that interplay between the sort of the particle physics and the nuclear physics that's really making it very challenging. So Kendall already talked about this a little bit, so I won't belabor the point, but sort of the basic problem that we have is that neutrinos come in unobserved, and then there's a variety of stuff that comes out. And we really want to know what the incoming neutrino energy was, and we want to know the flavor, too. And it's tricky because you often have incomplete final states, or you have degeneracies. So you might observe some final state that could be due to a variety of different initial states. So you might have had a neutrino with some energy and some probability that it was able to produce this particular final state kinematics. And then you have another one that might have produced some other particle that was absorbed and had some invisible signature associated with it. And so on and so forth. And you know, what we see in the detector, of course, are just these particles. And there's a degeneracy of initial states in some senses. So what we basically try to do is we try to build this sort of like this map where we have some observed topology and we want to map that to a list of possible inputs. And we'd like to know the probability of what that input was and what the underlying physics was, what the energy of the neutrino was, what its flavor was, these different things. And you know, for measurements, we use the event generator, remember, to predict backgrounds and compute efficiencies and so on and so forth. And so there are certain imperfections that can be tolerated because you can constrain things with data. You can constrain backgrounds with data. But you know, you end up eating a lot of systematics, basically, when your models are suspect. And so if you can improve the models, you can beat down the systematics. And basically, the more measurements we have, the more better we're able to over-constrain everything. The better this sort of map becomes. So sort of requirements. So the generator has to simulate all the types and momenta of every particle that appears in the final state. So on some generators, like for instance on the sort of the energy frontier, the generators are often basically computation aids for theorists. But Genie doesn't work that way. And it's because we really lack a theoretical framework that's complete and consistent. We don't have one model that we can use to cover everything. You know, an ideal input theory would be internally consistent, and it would provide fully differential cross-sections and the kinematics of everything in the final state over all the reaction mechanisms, energies, targets, all these different things. But we aren't given that. Usually we're given something that maybe covers the final state kinematics for the lepton only, and usually with some limited range and energy or some other piece of phase space. We might be given something that's fully exclusive, or we might be something that's fully inclusive, but there's generally no guidance on how to kind of merge those regimes. And so what do? Well, the experiments have to go on, so we stitch together an ensemble that is consistent with all the data, and that's why, you know, some might argue that Frankenstein's monster should actually be our mascot, because we put these things together that we call Franken models, where we've had to stitch together different pieces of physics to cover the entire observable space. Okay, so what else do neutrino event generators typically provide? So there's usually like a full-blown toolkit that comes with them. So, you know, in Genie at least, there's interfaces to geometry engines for modeling complex detectors, flux drivers for computing exposure and normalizing responses to accelerator beams, event-free weighting engines for studying systematic uncertainties, databases of electron and hadron and neutrino scattering experiments, often with plotting tools for comparing the simulation to the data. The nucleon decay generators, libraries of pre-computed cross-sections, there's typically a whole big package of stuff that comes with a generator. So then Genie. So I'll start talking about Genie now. So Genie is this. Here's our guy. So the idea behind Genie was it was supposed to be a universal event generator. It can run in electron and hadron scattering mode. There's a lot of tools built in, like I talked about on the previous slide. The event handling is decoupled very cleanly from the physics routines, so it's possible to create arbitrary algorithm stacks. You can really code up kind of anything, and the framework is very accepting in sort of how it's able to manage it. It's run by a collaboration, an international collaboration, about a dozen collaborators, you know, basically all experimentalists, and then there are many more contributors. And we sort of divide the two in the way we think about things, because collaborators have to do service work, so things like validation, distribution, user support. I spend a lot of time answering user questions, developer support, that sort of stuff. And then contributors are often people who come along and might offer like one piece of validation software or code up one model or do one specific piece of consulting, but who aren't necessarily interested in taking on some of the other pieces that go along with really, you know, keeping the software running and alive. So we have sort of two levels of involvement. So what is it? So we build this global physics model from a collection of exclusive state models. As I say, many of which are wrong but useful. So when we add a new process, strictly speaking, we need to retune the total cross-section because we're adding some new strength. And we've previously tuned, or at least to our best ability, to the total cross-section, so it changes things. And we try to be very hard to be consistent with the data for the total cross-section. So you know, inclusive calculations are still valuable, even if they're difficult for us to implement directly. And then we also try, of course, to agree with as many other measured distributions as possible, but there are always tensions that are difficult to understand and reconcile, and so we always have to kind of like pick, you know, do we kind of, how we match up against the variety of distributions. And so here is just a couple of validation plots. These labels are all impossible to read, I know, but they're all just different experimental data sets for the total cross-section for CC inclusives in neutrinos and then anti-neutrinos. And so how does it actually work? Well, the first thing that we do is we compute the total cross-section for the input energy, flavor, helicity, and target isotope. So for each phenomenological model in Cycini, we compute this big spline. We call them splines, just cross-section spline. And then we perform a sum over these exclusive channels. So we fail quantum mechanics 101, we square and then sum, but we don't know really how to put these the interferences in, so this is what we have to do. And then the pre-computation of the cross-section is computationally very expensive, involves hundreds of millions, possibly billions of differential cross-section evaluations, but you only have to do that once per release. We provide pre-computed cross-sections that cover very wide energy ranges and a ridiculously long list of isotopes here, and there's other ways to get them. If you're at Fermilab, we have software tools for distribution that most experiments use. So what does it look like on the inside? Well, as I mentioned, it's this sort of incoherent sum. So our default model that if you just run Gini contains these different pieces. It contains a quasi-elastic piece, a resonance piece, a DIS piece, a coherent piece, some more DIS, stuff like neutrino electron, IMD, et cetera. And then there are alternative models that you can turn on that are sometimes grouped together. So for instance, you can use a different physics list that contains just diffractive events. And you could, in principle, of course, also put those into your default. There's a lot of flexibility here. This is just a tiny sampling of kind of what this stuff looks like. I don't want to show too much XML, because usually if you're showing XML, you're losing. All right, so how does it work? So OK, so once you have the total cross-sections in hand, event generation proceeds by projecting rays through the detector geometry and computing the total path length over all the materials along the trajectory. At the start of the run, we bathe the detector with a bunch of these rays to find the longest path length through the detector, and then we normalize the interaction probability to 1 on that path and scale up all other interaction probabilities appropriately, and then propagate that information into the flux driver for doing exposure bookkeeping. And we do this because it's necessary to keep running times reasonable. Otherwise, neutrino cross-sections are so low, you would have to propagate an awful lot of neutrinos to your detector before you actually had an interaction. And then for any given path, events are chosen randomly by channel according to their contribution to the total cross-section in an accept-reject loop. So why do we need geometry? This is a point of pride for Gini. Well, experiments have need to generate interaction vertices in the correct locations. Fluxes vary in intensity and energy profile across the detector. Detector structures have specific structures and boundaries, and it's very different. So it's very complex, but we work hard to make it work. And we also make sure that you can use the same geometry file for Gini as you give to Jayant for simulating the detector simulations. That way you don't have translation errors between the two. And then same thing with fluxes. You have many choices. It's easy to feed it histograms or encapsulations of common parameterizations that are provided by default. You can grab those. We also have some simple generic n-tuple formats that we support. This is not so much the case anymore. We still continue to support some experiment and institution-specific stuff, but that's sort of falling out of favor these days. You can wrap any of the above in a flavor blender adapter. So this is how you handle far detectors in an oscillation experiment. And then some of these drivers have exposure counters and things like that, so you can normalize your exposure, basically. Okay, so how does it work? Continuing that theme. So currently implemented models basically rely very heavily on a factorization assumption. Some of them blend these assumptions, but for the most part, we have different chunks of code that are responsible for simulating the nuclear model, then simulating the primary interaction, then simulating hadronization, then simulating hadron transport. There's modules thrown in there for decay of unstable hadrons. We're starting to add pieces for decay of the remnant. Currently, we basically leave the remnant nucleus in sort of a funny state. We don't do a lot with it, but that's changing. So, okay, another slide with a lot of text that's hard to read, but the sort of the bottom line is that there's just a kind of a list of what the defaults are for the most part. So the default nuclear model is still a relativistic Fermi gas with the Bodek and Ricci high momentum tails, and then we implement a bunch of alternatives. The quasi-elastic process defaults to Llewellyn-Smith, but we also have, you know, alternatives. We have a default axial form factor model, but we have alternatives that are going to be the default for shortly. The excitation of nuclear resonances and coherent pion production are both described by models by Ryan and Segal, but again, there's a large number of alternatives. And then we offer a diffractive pion production model as well. Models for neutrino electron scattering and inverse muon decay are included in mostly complete modulo some of the radiative corrections that Kevin was talking about earlier.
So when you say quasi-elastic, you mean nucleon for quasi-elastic process?
Yeah. We also offer, not turned on by default, a custom built, and then the Valencia 2P2H models. So we use Bodek and Yang for the non-resonant and elastic scattering. And then there are other interesting exclusive states, so like quasi-elastic hyperion production, single cam production, et cetera, that are optional. We haven't turned them on by default yet because that would lead to some defaulting, or excuse me, some double counting in the way the hadronization model is tuned. We have a custom hadronization model that basically uses Pythia at sort of high W for neutrinos, very, very low W for if you talk to the Pythia authors. And then we have a custom KNO model sort of below W, about 2.3. It's 100% this KNO model. We have a couple of internally developed models for final state interactions. One of them is a cascade model, sort of what you would think of as a classical cascade model. And then the other which is the default, sort of parameterizes the cascade into a single effective interaction, which makes it very fast and very easy to do reweighting. So you can reweight your final states based upon all kinds of interactions inside the detector or inside the nucleus. And then we use the SCAT parameterization for formation zones. And then there's more detail in the backups. So just to kind of break that down into pieces so you can kind of again see, the color is maybe a little funny here, but there's a sort of a chunk that's responsible for the ground state, which includes actually choosing where the interaction was, which is basically done with a simple nuclear density model, although that blends a little bit if you're using local Fermi gas. Then there's an initial state nuclear model, which is telling you what the initial momentum of your target nucleus inside the, excuse me, your target nucleon inside the nucleus is, and there's a variety of options. Then there's a hard scattering process where you compute the differential cross-section to get event kinematics. And then there are modules that compute, you know, from that, once you've picked your event kinematics, there are modules that compute what your lepton and your hadronic system looks like, modules for propagation and transport. I mentioned the default is an effective cascade, which is fast and reweightable. And then we also handled decays before and after propagation. Then there's the remnant decay. We've sort of just started caring about the remnant recently, but you know, the current model is very simple, but we're working on something that's much cooler, where we use other codes. We're working on building interfaces into JNOT4, INCL++, possibly Jabou, to handle clustering, de-excitation, evaporation, those sorts of things in a way that's more realistic. Previously, most neutrino experiments weren't very sensitive to this, so Genie was developed for Minos. Minos is completely insensitive to this. But liquid argon detectors, in principle, might be sensitive to some of the details of the what the remnant is doing after the interaction's happened, it's falling apart. Certainly experiments like Annie are sensitive to that kind of thing. Sometimes models can't work this way in the sort of the factorization that I've laid out here. So sometimes you can't separate lepton and hadron kinematics into separate modules. Sometimes you have to choose the nucleus that you interact with along with the sort of event kinematics. Strictly speaking, you should actually always do that, but that code runs slower, and so we're still working on ways to make that process fast enough to be more widely used. Right now, we have code to do this for quasi-elastic events, but not anywhere else. Okay, so a little bit on the FSI models. So there's the HA model that I mentioned, where we use iron reaction and carbon reaction, cross-section data, isospin symmetry, and then A to the 2/3 scaling to predict the FSI reaction rate. So individual particle energies and angles either use some data templates or sample from the allowed phase space. And this is all, I think this is all simulation in these plots. It's hard to get really good HA validation plots. But if because it's basically parameterized to match data, if I had data on these plots, you would see it basically agrees with the different pieces, or at least the total would agree very nicely. And then where you had elastic and inelastic, it would agree too. Sort of by construction. Of course, that's assuming that you can do that, which it's not clear. That's a good assumption from a physics perspective. We also have a cascade model, and we call HN. Don't ask me where HA and HN, where those names came from. I'm not sure where they came from. There's a new development in that sort of over the last year or so. We've finally incorporated the OSET model for in-medium corrections for pion propagation. And here are some validation plots just for that new piece, basically looking at pi plus on carbon, looking at the reaction total cross-section, the absorption cross-section, and the charge exchange cross-section. And then, so for hadronization, as I mentioned, we have this custom model. You can kind of see, this is a function of W. You can kind of sometimes see where ours is turning off and Pythia is turning on. But there's a lot of validation that we do for that. Currently, we're using Pythia 6, and we're migrating to Pythia 8. Most of the validation, of course, is using deuterium or hydrogen. There's very little influence from nuclear effects on any of this, or any validation done with nuclear effects. You can read more about it there. And then this slide also is, you know, I'm not going to expect everyone to read all this, but the important points are there's sort of a W min and a W max where we start to turn off our homegrown KNO and turn on Pythia, 100% Pythia by the time you get to 3 GeV. And then here's just another plot that is more sensitive to the KNO piece where, because I mean, this is sort of Pythia matters more out here, where you look at the number of charged particles over the average number of charged particles, and you can see comparing at some different data sets, and you can see down here at low W. Well, I guess this is, you get low W by looking at the whatever those dots. You can see it's doing okay throughout. Okay, then we also mentioned that we run an electron scattering mode. Some of the distributions look pretty good. Basically, this is a variety of angles. I know it's impossible to read from back there, but it's a series of angles. I think it's like 20, 30, 38, something like that. At 2.4 GeV, we're looking sort of okay. Up at 3.3 or something GeV, you can start to see there's some problems. But we can run in this mode, and we're trying to get better performance out of it. Okay, so since this is a...
I'm just trying to figure out where what the pattern is to where the problems are. So basically, low W, it's okay, and high W...
For these plots, yeah. I don't know that I would say that that's a global feature of the, because this is a very big plot book, and I tried to pick one that was illustratively good and one that was illustratively bad, but it's, I don't know that, but yeah, so.
What exactly happens at 2.9 GeV squared?
You know, I'm not sure what happens there.
Isn't that where your GIS model fully kicks on?
Probably, yeah. That's
resonance model turns off?
Yeah, that's probably right.
But it shouldn't make such a drastic step, right?
It shouldn't which?
Make such a drastic step.
Well, it does. I don't know. Yeah.
This piece of data doesn't make a drastic step.
Yeah, well, yeah. So it's hard to read what this says. Yeah, so the blue is the non-resonance background, and then the red is the resonance piece. So the resonance piece is indeed turning off, and the blue is just, it's just not well tuned there.
Yeah, it's possible that this just doesn't have the deep neural nets part turned on.
Yeah, it might not. I'm
not
sure. It might not be.
So the software,
the fit that I use is Gini? Yeah, the solid curves, the black is the Gini total, and then the points are points from data sets, and I'm not sure which ones they are. I could dig it out. I mean, we keep the references inside the validation codes.
But it's not a fit.
Right? No, there's no fit.
There's no electron scattering data of this type explicitly fit.
Right, there's no fits. It's just, that's right, it's just the prediction of the generator. Well, the main conclusion is that we can run an electron scattering mode, right? That you can tell Gini, you can give Gini a neutrino and it will do its level best with it. And you can give it an electron and it will, you know, it will do things with it. You can give it a hadron and it will do things. So it can run in all three modes. And that's the takeaway, is that it can run in a variety of modes. The other takeaway is that some pieces of, you know, the electron data look decent and others don't look as good. Right, so that's the other takeaway.
But you said it's validation for
Gini. Right, so we think of ourselves mostly as serving like the neutrino community. So there aren't really electron scattering experiments that use us as a generator and come to us with demands of you need to implement this model and so on and so forth. We actually do have some customers in the hadron scattering community, but it's a very small minority. So we use the electron scattering data as ways to validate other pieces of our model. So our final state interaction model, to the extent that we tune it on neutrinos, we would like to see it also reproduce and work well on with electron data, just as an example.
I'm now completely confused. So this is scattering of the data, is scattering of electrons on?
On hydrogen.
So this is electron-proton scattering, basically.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, but when you see that it doesn't work in some kinematic regimes, what does it mean for the neutrino?
Well, I mean, as Kevin was saying, that probably we don't have a DIS model for electrons, so that's why it just sort of drops off out there. And that's part of it. Why you have disagreements in other regions? Well, it's because the model that we have might work reasonably well for neutrinos, but it's not working for electrons.
No, I mean, the data is very fairly imprecise.
That's also true. Yes.
That's what I'm saying. These are nice data.
And there's no nuclear effects here, right?
There's no nuclear effects here, that's right. This is hydrogen. That's right.
Yeah, the problem there is that with parameterizing the resonance region, all of the models usually assume multiple expansion, right? So at threshold, you have P to the power L. Mm-hmm. Type of dependence. So P is the invariant mass, minus it's the momentum of the final state, basically. And when you look at the behavior with respect to energy, if you go to higher W squared, these pieces with P to the power L, they explode.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why usually you put a cut at 2 GeV or 1.8 GeV, because the parts that fit, for example, delta resonance excitation,
mm-hmm.
of ion production, so that e to the power L from delta will explode by the time you reach 2 GeV or 4 G or 3 GeV squared. Mm-hmm. So that's why there is a cut. But seriously, you just need to look at the way to connect between the resonance and extrapolate into non-resonance region. I know that Eric Christie had nice.
But one thing to say about this resonance model, right? This is a terrible model. The only reason that it's used is because it's the model that has the calculation of all the quantum numbers relevant for neutrino scattering. But in terms of being state of the art, you just got electron data, this is a horrible model. Among other things, the square then sum problem bites this badly, so mm-hmm. that there's interference between the blue and the red curves, and it's just not in.
That's right.
It's just not put into this model. It's
That's
just
right.
simply wrong. And again, this is the model that happens to have done the calculation that has all the right quantum numbers that you need to make a neutrino scattering prediction. But if anyone wants to work on a region of model space that needs help, it's just rotten to the core on the right. neutrino side, it's the resonance part. The transition region between the delta and DIS.
That's actually what I'm trying to understand. So if you say this is validation for what you do in the neutrino scattering, which part do you check here and
well,
does it work? And it seems
works,
to have a
works.
Profound impact on what you
yep.
do in the neutrino.
Sure.
Right.
So here you have nice data, so you could use it to get this right, and
no.
then you have this
But
model.
you can't take this and turn it into a prediction for neutrino scattering.
But didn't you just say that? If you move the resonance model, then it also has an impact on the neutrino scattering.
But you can't somehow correct this model based on the electron scattering data and then predict something for neutrino scattering. That does not work.
So then what is the validation?
Well, at some level, it's to see can we run it with electrons. The other thing is, maybe you should pick more illustrative plots. You try to look at quantities where you think you have good overlap in the model. Right, so anything that's sensitive to the final state interaction model is more interesting in some sense to look at for validation purposes. To be perfectly honest, we don't spend a lot of time looking at these plots for release validation for neutrinos because they're a little depressing. But I mean, for the big takeaway here is that we could run an electron scattering mode, We do try to use it in some ways to try to help validate other pieces of the model. As Kevin said, it could certainly use a lot of work. I mean, the electron piece could use work. We don't have customers is one of the things. Like, my electron scattering experiments don't really seem to need event generators the way that neutrino experiments do.
So then I understand, but it doesn't help for the neutrino generator.
Well, it does for some pieces of it. I mean, these particular distributions maybe don't drive home that point. I mean, again, there's a huge plot book. I tried to grab a couple. I should have thought more. I tried to grab a couple where you had some regions that looked okay and other regions that looked bad, right? So in kind of the low W over here looks sort of okay, low W over here looks bad. And that was sort of the point, was that some regions look okay and some regions look bad.
Maybe my characterization of, you know, rock to the core sounds a little harsh, but right. Actually I claim this is validation that that's true.
Yes. there you go.
It validates that.
Yes, fair enough. So since this is a nominally workshop on radiative corrections, I'll talk about radiative corrections in Gini. And to first order, we don't do any. So there's some ongoing work, mostly at MIT, to include some basic effects. So there's no corrections for nuclear effects or anything like that. It's just some initial state, final state, and internal state radiation. And the postdoc who was there who's working on it sent me a couple of slides. So I will show you what she sent me. Basically, the idea is that for the initial state radiation, the goal is to subtract some energy momentum from the initial state probe according to a given distribution. And then on the final state, this will actually be applicable both the electron and the neutrino mode, try to add a final state photon and keep record of the decay. There's some debate that I don't fully understand about doing this between whether it's something that tries to be done in JAINT or Gini. That seems like there's potential for that to interfere between what's being done on the internal side, so I have questions about what's going on with that comment.
You mean like what Photos does?
I don't know. I don't know exactly what she meant by doing this in JAINT and Gini. And so, I mean, I asked a follow-up question along the lines of, like, couldn't that lead to some interference with this internal piece? And she said yes. So anyway, and so then, and there's a couple of approaches that are being considered for the internal. Basically, I mean, these are simple formulas that are being used to do some simple corrections. The point here is that there's basically no radiative corrections in Gini, and the stuff that's sort of ongoing is fairly primitive.
What's M?
M? Which M?
Your last formula.
Down here?
Q squared over M squared.
Oh, gosh, probably the, probably the lepton.
But I would encourage great caution in implementing something like this and unleashing it on people.
Right. Well, it'll be optional. We use Pythia for hadronization.
Oh, just hadronization.
Yeah, just for hadronization. And that's basically all the neutrino event generators use Pythia for hadronization. So we do, NUVRO does, Jibu does, Newt does. There's just differences in what people do at low W. So Gini has a prescription at low W. Newt has some different prescription at low W. I think NUVRO just runs it all the way down to W of 0.
To the delta.
To the delta? Oh, okay, all right. And then maybe Jibu runs it down pretty low. I forget exactly how far they run it down. But there's difference. Everyone handles low W region differently. But for once you get above the W of 2 or 3, more or less, people are using Pythia. OK, so future. So new release upcoming soon, Gini 3.0. So we just had a release a little while ago that put in a whole big slew of new models. So the idea behind the next Gini release is to basically make it much easier for people to switch between different configurations and to make it easy to encode a new configuration into a constellation of models and parameters. And it should ideally be a command line switch so that you could flip between different configurations. Right now, actually setting and configuring Gini, while is not that hard, does require some reasonably expert knowledge. You have to have some idea what you're doing to actually get it all right. And then, of course, there'll be some default, and we're going to be doing some tuning in these different pieces. And there's a few different pieces that were sort of basic variations that we're testing right now to go along with 3.0. And they have funny names. Basically, the first is the default as it exists now. The next one would be adding the empirical MEC model. The next one would be doing the sort of Valencia MEC and the Valencia CCQE, and then switching to local Fermi gas. And then the next one would also put in the Z expansion for this guy. And then here is just an example comparing one bin of the mini boon double differential, looking at these different models. So here is, this is, I think, the black, and then this is the red, and I think this is the green, comparing to one slice of the mini boon neutrino double differential, just to give you some idea. It doesn't tell the whole story, of course, because there's hundreds of plots for that sort of stuff. So there's a new comparisons package, a whole suite of code for generating these different little model comparison plots. We're covering effectively all the modern neutrino cross-section experiments on, you know, nuclear targets, so mini boon, T2K, Minerva, et cetera. A lot of historical neutrino stuff is in there, bubble chamber experiments, et cetera. And then, you know, measurements of neutrino-induced hadronic system characteristics, et cetera. So the next genie, Genie 4.0, so Genie, we imagine Genie 4.0 is going to follow Genie 3.0 relatively quickly. We're going to do some significant amount of tuning, though, for Genie 4.0. And the plan is to use a package called Professor, which was developed, I believe, by Atlas, to do sort of large fits and tuning, where you can include a wide variety of different parameters in your fit. And so there is a collaboration ongoing. This is being done mostly in Liverpool and is actively ongoing. And there's a few slides sort of showing the status. So first, just briefly, kind of how Professor works. So the idea is you give it a bunch of bins, and then it basically parameterizes those data points with some polynomial, and then it actually does the minimization according to the polynomial. And it works well with about up to kind of 15 parameters. As you start getting beyond that, it starts getting dicey in terms of holding things together. I'll show some examples in just a second. So here's a first example, perhaps, of this. Oh, this is hopelessly tangled now. All right, so some benefits of a professor, as I mentioned, so it's highly, this approach is highly parallelizable. You can do your event generation in parallel, and then you build these polynomials, and then the fit is very fast. It's pretty advanced software, so you can take into account correlations, and you can do bin-specific weighting, and so on and so forth. It can handle nuisance parameters. It's a pretty good minimization algorithm. And so here is a completely impossible to see data covariance matrix for the set of data that we're looking at, which again is a sort of a zero pi tune, so it includes the mini boon, neutrino and antineutrino CCQE, T2K zero pi data, and then CCQE and antineutrino CCQE from Minerva. And you can't tell from this plot, but like sort of in the mini boon region, there are no off diagonal terms. And then as you get that toward T2K and Minerva, you've got off diagonal terms.
But there are no off diagonal terms because you don't have them.
That's right. That's right. It's not because we just decided to sort of. There are challenges, and you will see that on the subsequent slides.
Yeah, my characterization seemed to be very harsh, but not inaccurate.
That's right. Well, since I'm at the podium, I'm using a bit more euphemistic language. But anyway, so in this particular example, so this is sort of a trial example. The parameters being tuned, and some of you will have to avert your eyes, include MA, the CC cross-section scale, the resonance scale, the fraction of MEC events that you let in, and then some pion FSI terms, basically, to kind of control some of the different final state pieces. And so those six parameters were thrown in. There's the parameter covariance. Here's the prediction covariance. Again, it's like impossible to read. But anyway, this comes out of the propagation of the parameter covariance. It's not used so far, but in principle, you could use it to propagate systematics to other parameters. So they did a global fit and then an individual fit. So again, it's a big table of numbers. I don't expect everyone to like read all of them in 1 second, but the slides will be available later. Basically, sort of the MA and the cross-section scale factors are in sort of good agreement between the individuals with each other and the global fit. The FSI parameters are not. The agreement with data is reasonable, which means better than the original model. So something to be said for that.
Based on attempts to do these kinds of bits within T2K is, let's take a look at this mech fraction 0.5 plus or minus 0.08.
Mm-hmm.
Like, given all of my concerns about the implementation of our 2P2H models, the limitations on those 2P2H models, the different other uncertainties, I know that I personally can't believe that, you know, that we would know this 2P2H fraction at the 10% level. That just strikes me as crazy. So what are the feedback loops for building in other uncertainties or thought or statements that Jeannie can make about, well, okay, you know, so we did this, we tossed this in, but here's another window that we looked at, and this is a reason to believe, like, are you guys going to take this as canon, or are you going to give other people advice about where the limitations of the model are that you might want to use to inflate the uncertainties or something? Just, I'm a little scared of and this is tough because I'm being recorded, and I mean everything I'm saying in not an overly critical, but just an honest way. Mm-hmm. I could see a future where somebody could just walk in the door and say, oh no, totally, we know this to this percent, you know, why do we need these theoretical groups? Or other TDK collaborators that ask us, like, why are you wasting your time on this? We know this at the 10% level.
Well, so, you always have to keep in mind what the sort of the global goodness of fit is, right? I mean, this is what this is, right, at some level, which is that there's a technical interpretation to those parameters. And then you can exercise individual judgment on whether you think that the conclusions based on the inputs are sort of valid or not. So, I mean, I think the goal here would be to take a variety of different Gini configurations, tune them to something aside from what they are now. Right now, these all fit, well, I'd have to study the numbers a little carefully before I say they all fit better. But there are groups of them that fit better than what the current default model is now. Right, and so we think are reasonable and appropriate directions to push the model. I don't think that, you know, we're not claiming that the uncertainty on this term is really, 8% our uncertainty on the fraction of MEC that's included. That's not the claim. The claim is to try to build a better set of initial defaults, at least initially, and then we'll push from there. We don't think that we can necessarily include, for instance, all of the different data sets together. There's tensions if you put all of them together, but in particular, you might have a very different tune for like your zero pi sort of low energy, low Q squared region than you might have for a very high energy DIS portion of the model.
So that's a good point. I think it is extremely important to provide these tunes. I guess what I'm saying is another critical part though is the uncertainty that you assign to any given process. So alongside this process, and maybe it's further down the line, how are the uncertainties going to be set on various parameters? Right now, there's just a table that you go in.
Yeah, and I would argue that the table that we have now is really not any better justified than any of what these numbers are, right? I mean, at some level. So, you know, what you do is you come and you have parameters on models that you hope at least are wrong, right? I mean, all of these models have issues for all the reasons that I laid out in the very beginning. We might choose to inflate some of these numbers. So for example, you could imagine one of the knobs in the model being what is your MEC fraction. And you could imagine an uncertainty appearing inside Gini that was basically like the one sigma knob default from when you're rerunning the generic reweighting engine, right? So that's how those things mechanically show up in the code. And the number that we finally choose to stick in for that, you know, it probably won't be 0.08. I don't know what it'll be. But we will, as with previous iterations of this, go and look at those parameters and see what we think is reasonable and try to justify the numbers that we put in. It's as you know, it's not like there's one simple algorithm that I can just tell you, follow these three steps and all these numbers are magically correct. It involves a lot of judgment, a lot of comparing different data sets, a lot of looking at, you know, deciding which one you trust more and why. Valuing the different pieces of the fit, it's a complex process to get all of that laid out, right? And then in the end, experiments are always encouraged to evaluate those numbers for themselves and change them if they think that they're appropriate. Certainly, you know, we do in Minerva go and change some of the numbers apart from what Gini suggests as defaults, both in terms of like the central value of these kinds of parameters and in the uncertainties. And there's discussions about that inside the collaboration, and you know, those numbers are going to change, particularly as you take data, right? I mean, as you learn more.
So this is your default model that is in you tune these parameters. This is the one you wrote down.
Let's see. So okay. So this was the.
It's in the button.
This was the current. Well, basically, this is the current default, I believe.
And you had before. you made changes on the point system with the model, and so you had different.
Sure, sure. And this is.
So if you pick another one, you're the same.
You might see something very different. So this is with a particular MEC model, and this is a particular CCQE model, and all of those different things. That's
so
right.
This difference, how would you phrase it as uncertainty, or what is it?
Possibly. So, you know, we haven't offered multiple tunes like this before, so we're still sort of thinking through what the best way to sort of package that is. You could imagine either carrying a constellation of uncertainties with each configuration, or you could imagine trying to provide some kind of global prescription. Probably you have to do something more like the previous, because some models will have knobs that the others don't. So if you choose one constellation of models, so for instance, the reason why we picked this empirical MEC for this test is because it has a very large number of free parameters, right? So this is a model that one of our collaborators came up with. It's based on some solid theoretical inspiration, but there's a very large number of free parameters in there. There's like 7 or maybe 11 free parameters. There's a bunch. The one that comes out of Valencia has, I think, one parameter, maybe, right? Because this was written down by a theorist, and you know, there are no free parameters. Or I think there's one. Well, I guess we could always squeeze one in, which is like some overall normalization. We can always tack something like that on. But there's many, many, many fewer parameters. So in terms of like the pieces that you would build into the code to try to make it easy for someone to reweight their sample and to vary the model predictions where they can be reweighted across these parameters, they would have to be different for different constellations. So, I mean, some of this is tortuous, I know, but it's sort of the world that you live in where you don't have one model that can describe everything. You have to figure out how to assemble these pieces, and there's different sort of prescriptions and approaches to it. Okay, so here's just a couple of plots showing a couple of bins from the Mini-Boon double differential, showing what the pre and post tune, what that looks like. And again, this is, you know, you shouldn't read too much into this because I've just picked a couple of random plots out of a plot book. This is doing the same for the Minerva CCQE, and it's illustrating a pitfall that you hit in these kinds of fits. You know, you can't see these labels down here, but up here you can, that the red has a better chi-square than the black, but if you're looking at the black, you would assume that the black was the better fit. And sometimes you get these sort of anti-intuitive results in chi-squares when you have covariance matrices that have some structure that can pull the results of the fit in sort of unintuitive ways. And so that's something that we're in the process still of dealing with.
There's a nice reference from Byron Rowe. He basically just said sort of a reformulation of exactly how you're building your chi-square to circumvent this. So let me know when I can send you a reference.
Sure, that'd be great. The sort of thing that we're considering doing is instead of doing Gaussian errors, doing log normal. I don't know if that's what he's doing.
Yeah, basically was saying just turn it into a lead instead of chi-square, you have the same ingredients. So I suspect it's probably the same solution.
Probably something similar. But, yes. Oh, sorry, but this is just sort of where it is right now.
So you're doing chi-squared to the double differential, or?
No, this is not a double differential. This is a single differential.
Because in the previous one, you had Mini-Boon.
Yeah, the previous one was Mini-Boon, and there's no covariance matrix for Mini-Boon, so we avoid this whole problem. It's a feature, not a bug. And then this is two separate ones. So it's the same underlying global model, but the chi-squares are different. I didn't bother writing them down for the antineutrinos. You can, it's like 6.8 and 5.8 by the look of it. So they're both lower. But I mean, what I wanted to illustrate was just sort of the state of things, and to show that if you looked at plot books right now, you would see things like this, and then this is why you're seeing that.
Sorry, when you say best fit, are you fitting? What are you fitting?
So that was back here. So it was these parameters. So we floated the MA and the CC scale, the res scale, the MEC fraction, and then these two different, so this is the mean free path for the FSI for pion, mean free path for interaction, and this is probably the absorption cross section.
The errors are, I'm just looking at the size of the errors also. It's only just
sure.
The percent level, basically.
Percent level. Well, yeah, I mean, those are the parameters that come out of the fitter. Like, we just had a long conversation about how you treat those and sort of how much confidence you want to choose to put into those.
So a physical parameter, but you have a 10 sigma discrepancy between your MA parameters.
And of course, as you say, it's not a physical parameter. It's not, you know, it's the right way to do this, in my opinion. This is what was done, but the right way to do this, I wouldn't use MA. I would take the deuterium data fit for the Z expansion, and I would not float that. I would just take that. And then I would move the sins of the nuclear model into other parameters that were dedicated to absorbing the sins of the nuclear model. Here, MA is carrying water for a lot of different pieces of the model, capital M model. So, okay. So Genie 3.0 should be soon. We're working on finalizing comparisons, and we need to do some work on the technical infrastructure to make it possible for people to switch configurations a bit more easily. Genie 4.0 is on an aggressive schedule. Also, the goal is this calendar year. There's been a lot of technical progress already, but there's a lot of thorny issues to work with, and so we'll see. We have a history of usually being about 6 months late on those kinds of things. So I'm going to leave us a little room to wiggle. Okay, so now it's for something completely different. So how am I doing on time? I'm just about out. Okay, so I'll just mention briefly basically the existence of a few of these other codes and try to provide some pointers. So Nuvro, as they themselves say, it's not an official Monte Carlo of any experiment, and so they see themselves really as a laboratory for new developments. If a new model is published, usually there's a Nuvro code release for it very quickly. They have been doing a lot of work. They're very actively involved in updating their model. They've recently added electron scattering. I'll show a slide on that in a second. But and then, as I mentioned, you can get their code from GitHub, and they have a user's guide. And there was a tutorial that was given at this school. It was the Genie MC, but there was a Nuvro tutorial there as well. There's a few plots for their electron scattering model. Hard to see, I know, since I've shrunk it down. But this is new, very new for them. And then they've also got the total cross-section. This is just their total cross-section for neutrinos over here. Also new to Nuvro are reweighting utilities, which I believe were written in T2K for Nuvro. So then there's the Jabu generator. It strives to be the best possible theory in all cases. The big distinguishing features for Jabu, in my mind, are the initial state and final state interaction models. So they have a substantially more sophisticated nuclear ground state than anything that we have in Genie or Nuvro or really anywhere. And then there's a totally different philosophy for the final state interactions. Rather than doing some sort of cascade model, they propagate particles through the nucleus using a quantum kinetic transport theory, which is fully relativistic. And then the initial and final state interactions come from the same Hamiltonian. So it's very sophisticated. It runs slow, but it's sort of the state of the art in this business for final state interactions. And it compares well to electron and neutrino data sets. It's not reweightable, and there's no geometry of flux engines, but you can see I've again just chosen a couple of random plots from recent talks by Ulrich showing what Jabu looks like with electron and with some random subset of neutrino data. And then this is a joke that no one laughed at, but anyway. Okay, so then also, this isn't exactly a simulation tool. Kendall mentioned it briefly, but I think it's important to bring up. Nuisance is a new package which has grown out of work in T2K. So it's an open source generator tuning framework. So they have tools for generating comparison plots and doing reweighting, fitting, all these sorts of things with interfaces to a variety of neutrino experiments, so you can generate your events with Genie, Nuvro, Jabu works also. I forgot to mention Jabu here. And then they have interfaces to the reweighting tools, at least when they're provided by those generators. And you can compute ad hoc weights as well on top inside Nuisance, so it's very flexible. It has a variety of different tuning mechanisms. Both there's a sort of a frequentist mechanism and there's a Bayesian mechanism. And it strives to be highly reproducible results via job cards so that you could encapsulate a particular tune or you could encapsulate a particular job in some very clean and shareable way. And then here's just a couple of example plots. And then this next page is also just sort of more example plots. So it's very easy to get Nuisance to run. Basically, for each time a new measurement is published, you can code up a new module inside Nuisance to make it easy to compare any set of generators to it. And then it's very easy to make these kinds of plots. And so here's just a couple of example ones, one from Miniboon, Minerva, T2K, and then one from Argonaut, just for fun, just so you could both look at the niceness of their plotting package, but then also maybe do some tiny bit of generator comparison. And then, as I mentioned, briefly, there's a couple of different built-in tuning mechanisms that you can use for parameter tuning. So Genie has its own mechanism, which is built on top of Professor, but this is an independent thing that these guys have coded up. So it's very nice, and they have a couple of different, like I said, a couple of different techniques with different pros and cons. So depending on what it is that you're trying to do, you can choose to use one tool or the other or both. And then I think that's that. And I think I managed to finish in about an hour. Yeah, all right. Other questions?
Could I ask a short question that you could give a short or long answer? So you were looking at electron proton elementary target data.
A little bit.
Suppose you took that in combination with infinitely precise neutrino, hydrogen, or deuterium data. Do you have slots within Genie to put such improved data? And have you thought about what you would do with improved data if there were a new elementary target neutrino experiment?
And we haven't thought about it a lot. We have, but certainly we would use it. We would be very interested in using it. So we don't have pre-built slots, but it's easy for us to write applications. I mean, our comparison and tuning framework is not so different from Nuisance in many regards. We build applications basically for individual measurements, and they can be all folded together into one sort of tuning or plotting exercise. So when you say infinitely precise, what I suppose what that means is that they would pull fits very strongly as a function of having very, very small error bars, basically.
I just mean to make it as clear as possible, suppose that it was precise.
Sure.
One of the impediments to doing such an experiment is the non-existence of a clear statement that this is what is needed. And if I did this well, I could do this.
Right. Well, and that's because, so there's a tricky piece, which is that even if we had perfect information on the free nucleon physics, translating that into perfect information on argon or carbon or something like that is still non-trivial, right? We don't necessarily have, I don't know of a perfectly unambiguous way to fold all of that together into one model that everyone agrees is correct.
Sure, so that's part of the long answer.
Yeah.
Is there we can talk offline, but
okay. A
first approach would be to take everything else constant and say, what is the uncertainty from these poorly known elementary amplitudes?
Mm-hmm. So that will maybe look better. Like, as I said, one of the things that I want to do is I want us to try to begin fixing pieces that we have a bit more confidence in. So instead of floating MA and a fit like that, taking deuterium fits with the Z expansion and then holding them fixed and trying to shuffle the sins elsewhere in the model so it's clear where those sins are, and you could look at the relative changes between, you know, improving the errors on the deuterium data, for example, what that would do to the overall uncertainties coming out of Genie. It's not a simple prescription though, right? Because the coupling between the nucleon and the nuclear models is sort of hazy.
It's a circle of validation.
Yes?
So going back to your radiative correction slide, I think
okay.
Some of the references you're trying to hide, maybe not trying to hide, but Robert Richard can comment more on these kind of things. But not this one.
I'm getting there.
Oh, yeah, okay. So you have this Mohan Tsai, and this is, I checked with it, this is the Mohan Tsai that I'm familiar with. So this is from January 1968, item number 2 there. So that's like 50 years old, almost 50.
There's other problems with this particular one, too. I don't know what it means to put the target thickness into this, because the way Genie works, it just doesn't work like that. So I disagree with trying to use this formula for that reason. And that actually implementing that into the Monte Carlo is technically a nightmare.
Yeah, I don't remember what year is volume 62. Probably, again, it's not even showing the year, so that would be actually more useful.
Sure. Well, I mean,
and I'm mentioning this because this is the purpose of this workshop, right? And discussing some of these things. And before Because you said this is an effort that is happening right now.
It's ongoing. So there's lots of time to interrupt and offer suggestions.
Because it would be have a more kind of organized fashion of discussing how you would include these kind of things, as opposed to independent efforts or something.
Yeah.
And I was asking about the mask there also, because that was the point that was Thomas was discussing Richard's work yesterday, right? That's exactly the point where we the 1GeV versus the electron mass, that's where this thing is not a really good expansion parameter.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, thanks, Gabe.
All right.